and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd be forced to endure amblyopia if I saw that you missed today's show. Digital inclusion furthers impact. More people than you'd expect don't have home access to the internet. This has implications for the people you are trying to help. Our panelists from the 2016 Nonprofit Technology Conference have each made digital inclusion a priority, and they share their wisdom. Cami Griffiths leads the Community Technology Network. Karen Lincoln is from the Stride Center, and Alicia Orozco is with the Chicana Latina Foundation. And your annual grants plan. We start with the basics, then move into goals and metrics. Finally, colleague engagement, so you're not alone making your plan and executing it. Diane Leonard is president and owner of DH Leonard Consulting. On Tony's Take Two, more NTC videos. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. You'll raise more money. Pursuant.com. And by WeBe Spelling, super cool spelling bee fundraisers, WeBeSpelling.com. Here is our panel on digital inclusion.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of 16 NTC, the Nonprofit Technology Conference in San Jose, California at the Convention Center. My guests now are Cami Griffiths, Karen Lincoln, and Alicia Orozco. Cami is Executive Director of Community Technology Network. She's seated next to me. Next to her is Karen Lincoln, Director of Business and Operations at the Stride Center, and Alicia Orozco is Manager of Administration and Special Projects at the Chicana Latina Foundation. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you.
You have a very provocative, interesting topic, digital inclusion to further your impact. I'm going to start in the middle there, Karen. Turns out that everybody in the country does not have access to the internet at home. I'm shocked to learn.
Actually, you're not alone in being shocked. A lot of people are very surprised by that. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% of Americans do not have access to high-speed internet in their home, and a huge percentage of them don't even have digital literacy skills.
20 to 25% throughout the country?
Yes.
Does that include in urban areas, or is it mostly suburban rural? No, urban?
It's yes. Both.
Alicia,
it's both.
Definitely is shaking your nodding very...
Right here in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Silicon Valley.
Yes, right here. And in San Francisco. It is incredible.
Do we know what the percentage is here just in the local area? Or
I don't have that number.
But we know that there is an inclusion issue here.
Right. Yeah, and it's right. Broken down by income, age, and education level. So in San Francisco, they did a report recently, and it showed 15% didn't have access, and that's in San Francisco where you'd think everybody's connected all the time. But there's pockets of poverty. There's people who don't have homes, and where do they access the internet? So a lot of people are going to libraries and other places to get online. So San Francisco's lucky, and California in general is ahead of the curve compared to the rest of the country, but there's still a divide, even though some people think that everyone's got a cell phone, so we're all connected, but that's not the case.
Okay. Well, we all hear about libraries as the alternative. Are there other alternatives besides libraries? What are they? Anybody?
Community centers, recreation centers, senior centers.
Okay.
Other nonprofits that provide services sometimes also offer access to computers, okay. But you don't always get training at those places. So that's what a lot of our organizations are focused on, is the training.
Yeah, okay. Yes. So not only the access, but also literacy.
Yes.
I'm sitting in front of this machine, but I don't know how to use it.
Yeah.
It's not doing me much good.
Yes.
Basically. Okay.
Right. And children are failing in schools because they don't have connection at home. And they are in schools where there are 5 to 6 students per computer at their school. So it's really, they're incredible. They're doing homework. They're doing essays on their phones, their parents' phones. And I take my hat off to them because they haven't given up. But that's not right.
Right.
Also, having access to things like libraries and community centers doesn't serve everybody. Because if you are homebound or don't have access to a vehicle or live in a neighborhood where it's not safe to go out at night, you don't have the ability to use those other services.
Or even maybe the cost to travel.
Exactly.
Even public transportation is not free, and for some people it may be a burden just to get to the alternative.
And we have met families who pack their kids who have homework with the computer they have, and they go park in the library parking lot to get their Wi-Fi, and their kids are doing their homework. Because if they go inside, they get timed out within an hour, mm-hmm. and most of the computers are already occupied.
Parking in the library parking lot for Wi-Fi access.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This is happening.
Yeah. Right here in San Jose.
San Jose, in Silicon Valley.
Yes.
And if you don't have a car, you're outside on a bench, or they call them the leaners. They're leaning yeah. against the wall using the internet from yeah. in the building.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. That should be enough motivation. All right. So now the issue is that we are, in our organizations, trying to help these people. We're trying to reach them. You know, here at NTC, we're talking about so much about multi-channel engagement. But if the people can't access the channels and don't know how to use the channels, mm-hmm. again, we're not reaching them. And we're trying to provide services a lot of times to this population. How do we, right? This is what
yes,
we're talking
yes.
about. How are organizations supposed to
do
prepare
that.
Themselves to reach these people? All right. Let's start close this time. Cammy, how do we start even to assess what the problem is among our constituency? Is that where we start?
It's a good place to start, and not everybody does that. They jump right in and they'll have a bank of computers there, or they literally let their clients use their own computers, which isn't necessarily the best idea.
Using staff computers.
Oh, yeah. And or you're helping them apply for jobs. They're sitting next to you and you're applying for the job on their behalf because you just want to help them apply. But what I would encourage folks to do is to partner with agencies who are already doing computer literacy or adult literacy or some way. Don't take it on yourself to train your constituencies or help them connect to the internet, but know who the partners in your community are and work with them to get them the training that they need. So we want people to be able to apply for jobs on their own, ideally in their homes.
In the privacy, or at least some degree of privacy.
Exactly, and taking their time, because a job application isn't something you should send six out in an hour. It should take an hour just to find one application that you want to fill out, and then several hours to do research and fill out the application, you know, appropriately. And it's a time intensive thing, and at the library, as Alicia said, you'll time out after an hour, and so libraries aren't always the solution for job seekers. So for a nonprofit who is stumped by this issue of their clients not being online, we'll go to where the training happens, partner. But if you have a needs assessment that you're deploying, integrate digital literacy or digital inclusion into that survey so you have some data to prove to the foundations that this is a need that you should give us funding for so we can help these people get online at home so they can provide access to their children to do homework, so they can do job search, so they can connect with family using Skype, research information, entertain themselves, whatever it is. The internet is this amazing revolution, and they should be able to join in.
Karen, what are some of the things we should be asking if we're doing a survey the way Cammy is suggesting to determine if we have a problem among our constituency?
For one thing, you need to be careful about asking if they have access to the internet or if they have internet access, because a lot
we
of
just
people
just talk about it. That's too vague, right?
Right.
Yes, I do. I can go to my community foundation, which is a 2.5 hour ride, and it costs me $6 to get there and $6 to come back, and I get timed out after an hour.
Or you're using your phone, and your phone isn't really where you're going to build skills that are transferable, et cetera.
Boy, I feel like I'm learning pretty quickly. Okay, all three of you, very good teachers, because I feel like I'm mastering this already.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at tonymartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
All right, so what should we be asking in a survey tool?
So I would ask things like, you know, do you have access at home? What do you want to use the internet for? Is it because you have a sense of isolation and you want to connect with your family? Are you looking for a job? Are you trying to better understand your health? I would get a better understanding of what skills they bring to the table. They may say they know how to use their computer, but does that just mean that they know how to look up something on an internet page? Or do they know how to create a Word document? You really need to dig into what skills they bring to the table, what access they have today, and what their goals are with that usage.
Okay. Alicia, you're doing a lot of nodding. Yeah.
Absolutely. So are you connected at home? Do you have equipment? Do you have an actual computer? Is it working?
Yes.
We find that a lot of them are, doorstops, like you said, Karen.
But someone might answer that question, yes.
Yes.
We have one, but it's worthless.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, your questions are very important. How would you benefit from having a working computer and knowing how to use it at home? And, you know, I ask everyone who's listening to us to start listening everywhere you go. If we go to a hospital, if you see your doctor, if you go to unemployment, anywhere that you go at school, everything is, you can get it online. Cami was at the tax place. You can download the forms online. A lot of people don't have that ability.
There should always be an alternative.
Well,
but if you can't, here's the alternative.
No. The idea, the thing we want people to know is that the world has gone there. But not everyone has access to that world. This is a social justice issue.
Yeah.
Are we leaving a percentage of human beings out of the 21st century? And it's not because they don't want to. We live, at least here in this area where we are, one of the most expensive areas in this country. People have 2 and 3 jobs just to pay rent. Several families living together. So when you tell them that they're going to have to pay $49, $50 a month for their internet and then buy a computer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now our listeners are people in nonprofits themselves. It's for small and mid-sized nonprofits. So, well, they may not, but now, you know, we're raising consciousness. But now we want to approach the problem is, how do you, the 10,000 plus listeners, approach your constituents who don't have access? I mean, how can you help them either gain access or how can you deliver your own services knowing that we have this enormous void that 20 to 25% of the population, which is much bigger than I would have thought. Mm-hmm. Let's continue. Karen, you want to pick up with, I mean, where do we take this next? Now, we've done some assessment work. We know what mm-hmm. our constituents are lacking. How can we help?
So I would say there's primarily 2 things that we can do, and both Alicia and Cami spoke about this earlier today. One is become familiar with the organizations in your area that are teaching digital literacy. Nonprofit work is very self-referential. Nobody can do everything. Become familiar with what services are available in your area for your constituents.
Okay.
And additionally, get the word out there. It's so unknown how big of a gap is being created in our population and how many people are being disenfranchised. And the only way that change happens is through awareness. So we all need to start talking about it.
Also, find out if you have a refurbisher in your community, for instance. We did that a lot in our project. So because they usually make computers available at no cost or very low cost, and then they offer support for those computers if they do break down. So refurbishing companies are important, and they're springing up all over.
Okay.
Low-cost internet. There's a lot of companies coming out with low-cost internet options. So Internet Essentials from Comcast is one that's been out for about 4 or 5 years, and now they have a pilot for seniors, so it's $10 a month. And it comes with a $150 voucher for a computer. So Comcast has something low-cost, AT&T, there's Mobile Beacon, Mobile Citizen. So know what the low-cost options are in your community that people can apply for. You advocate to your city government or your region to get low-cost or free access in low-income areas. So Google Fiber Fiber is doing some really interesting things connecting low-income housing to free internet. And so getting the low-cost or free option of both the internet and the connectivity is very important, but not everyone knows how relevant it is to them. So having the training is absolutely essential to help them understand why it's relevant and then how to use it safely. Because the safety part, especially for older adults, there's a huge amount of fraud in the older adult community and they're getting scammed out a lot of money. So if we can make sure that people, once they're getting trained online, they're learning how to do it safely.
Okay. Yeah, Karen, Alicia?
I will just mention that there's also a lot of lobbying that is being done with the PUC, with our legislature in
PUC,
Sacramento.
Public Utilities Commission?
Yes,
yeah.
Because there are mergers happening. And the Comcast offer of $9.99, it wasn't because they were so kind and wanted to help people. In fact, they were forced by the government and then they sat on it and did nothing. The California Emerging Technology Fund had money to give grants to all of us to get the word out. And that's how it began, by us getting involved and telling people, if you have a child in school receiving lunch, you know, free or reduced, you qualify for this.
Okay.
Well, I invite you all to look up California Emerging Technology Fund because they are very involved in lobbying and trying to get access to California. Their goal is 80% by next year, 2017.
80%
California's connected.
Access in-home?
Yes.
Okay. What would we search if we're not in California? I don't know if anybody else, but I just got this major breeze.
Yeah.
I'm shivering on camera, but if anybody's wondering why, the air just got turned up about 80%. I don't know. It feels like the air just got turned up 80%. All right. If we're outside California, what should we be Googling? What terms should we be searching to find the equivalent to what Alicia is talking about in our home state?
So there's the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, and I think the URL is digitalinclusion.org or something.
Okay,
NDIA is. And there's a listserv and there's a lot of us on it and there's lots of conversations. So if you were to join that and say, hey, what's happening in Salt Lake City?
Say it again, what it's called?
National Digital Inclusion Alliance.
Okay. Excellent.
And there's a conference coming up in Kansas City in May for folks who are interested in this world of digital inclusion.
Any other resources we can shout out at this point?
Nationwide. I think just put in digital inclusion in your Google search.
Okay.
You know, and some of these organizations, you know, CETFs, California Emerging Technology Fund, might be able to help you to say, okay, because they are involved actually nationally to a certain degree. Right. They go to Washington.
And of course, we got NDIA. Cami just gave us. Okay.
And yes. I'm happy to point people to other resources. I'm wanting to build my own network of who's doing what and sharing resources. And that's the only way I think I can get better at doing this work and to help us build a movement where we're training the trainer, because that's what CTN does, is trains trainers to teach free computer classes and works one-on-one with individuals. And I really think that's one of the only ways to meet the need, is to meet people where they're at in the language that they speak, using the device that they use, and to show them the things that they need to know how to do. And so if we can replicate that in a large way across the country and eventually the world, that's a way to address the need.
How can people reach you if they would like to participate?
They can email me at Cami, K-A-M-I, at ctnbayarea.org. And we've got resources on our website, and there's another conference for people in this space called Shelby Schools Health Library Broadband Coalition. That's a yearly conference that happens in D.C. I'll be going to that and speaking.
All right, say that one again, Shelby.
Shelby is Schools Health Library Broadband Coalition. It's a mouthful. But there's really great folks that go there, too, and it's all about getting people access to the internet and why do they need to use it and the skills to use it.
Okay. All right, there's more. We have more time together, so we haven't beat this topic up yet. Let's take a look. I'll give you a couple seconds to think about, and we're going to take a little commercial break because I have to highlight an N10 swag item. We have from Upleaf, coloring. The coloring, and our outstanding PA, Hannah, has taken some liberties with the owl. You can see that she's already started to color this in. But this is from Upleaf, and of course, they don't only give you the coloring sheets, but the coloring pencils as well. And Karen, I need your help. Would you add this to the N10 to my N10 swag pile?
Yes.
The sheet and the pencils go too. Oh, you got to put the pencils up front. That's, they can be seen. There it is. Color. That's okay. One fell, six. Okay, excellent. Thank you. And we could take that. All right. So, what more do we have to cover on this, this very important topic? Let's see. Let's give you some clues. Program delivery. We haven't talked about program delivery. Well, go ahead, Cammie. What do you want?
Want to encourage everybody to think about volunteering in their community to help make a difference in this area. If you know how to send an email and you're a good communicator, somebody in the community could benefit from you helping them learn how to use the computer. So if you have 2 hours to give once a week, you could really change somebody's life by helping them use their new smartphone that they got from their adult child, or use their laptop to apply for a job or improve their resume. There's so many ways that we take for granted what we know.
This could potentially be a volunteer opportunity for some of our organizations who listen.
Yes.
That they could create something around digital literacy.
Yes.
Within their community.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. We have, for instance, Chicana Latina Foundation supports Latina women to go to school, a higher education. We have a program for them. One of our alumni applied for a grant. She got $10,000 so that she could teach classes and have computer for people in Santa Cruz. So there's really a lot of ways that you can figure out how to help your community. She has now taught 100 people how to use a computer, and it was a 4-week course, and they all got computers based on this grant that she got on her own initiative while going to school and having a job.
Yeah.
And then she recruited students from Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, to join her and teach. So it was a beautiful, beautiful project.
And brought in students, college students, obviously.
Exactly.
Literate and connected. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's I'd like to move to program delivery. How do we start to break this down if we know that there are people we're trying to help who aren't connected at home? Where do we get started with this problem?
I think some of the things that you have to consider is not only what the community is, what they're trying to do, because the things you're going to teach a group of seniors is very different than a group of job seekers, for example. But if you're talking to people who are like food insecure or don't have the money, you really have to find a way to integrate technology into their life so they can start to see the value of it. And I think a good way to do that is to not only find out what matters to them, to find some way to subsidize the program for the first 6 to 12 months so that it does become a part of their daily practice. Because if you've never had it in your home, you don't know what value it is, and you don't understand why an investment of $10 to $40 is worth your time.
The other thing is that, for instance, if you are working with families who have children in school, we found that there are a lot of school liaisons who are actually volunteers who are doing this. They're training parents. They're on the internet. Well, not only internet, how to use a computer. So there's, depending on who your clientele or the community you are serving is, look around, because I bet that there are these other organizations that are doing the work or groups that are doing this work. The schools are very interested in getting the parents on the internet and on their school loop, or there's different names for it. But they would love to let their computer labs to be used. We did that in Santa Cruz. We did that in Salinas. We did that in Santa Rosa. It was the schools who opened their computer labs to be used by the community.
After school hours, you're talking about,
right? Exactly.
The things are sitting fallow. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Why not use them?
Okay. Yeah. So.
Okay. Cammie, anything you can add about the program? We're trying to focus on the
delivering
to people.
Yeah, partnering with other agencies and not taking it on yourself would be the first thing to do. Look out into your general vicinity. And if you're in a small town, there's no one else, you know it, good. Take the next step to learn more about other cities that are doing it. Learn from people like us, but don't try and do it yourself. It's really difficult work, and it gets harder if you're talking about older adults and cognitive disabilities or multiple languages being spoken in any one area. And that's the kind of stuff that we're dealing with. And, you know, we don't have computers of our own. We partner with senior centers, so we don't have to maintain the computers. We don't have to run the nonprofit that's housing the computers. We don't have to provide the meals that are drawing the seniors in there in the first place to then go to the computer center. So find an adult ed or a library or a school or somebody that has perhaps something that you can glom onto or you can work together. And if that doesn't exist, then really try and build a network of people who want to help out. And so a good place to go would be if there's a school or a university where you can elicit the support of a service learning program. We are partnering with USF to do that, and it's a really great resource for us. And, you know, utilizing volunteers is an amazing way to address the need, but they need to be trained and they need to be supported. And the volunteers like to get to know each other. So having a real robust volunteer program is essential, and continually helping them help their learners. So there's going to be questions about iPhones. We'll have an iPhone training. There's going to be questions about this new website they've never heard of. So have that kind of training for the trainers so they can be really good at communicating this technology to the learners. So it's really, and then one thing that we're doing is a monthly networking event we call Brag and Borrow. So people come together just to talk and brag about the cool stuff that they're doing related to technology access and training. And then the borrow piece is saying, well, I'm having this challenge, can you help me with that? So that's the one thing I've been doing monthly for about a year and a half that's resulted in some partnerships and me learning a lot about the different communities. So our last Brag and Borrow was at a veteran serving agency that had some computers. And so we had about 8 veterans organizations. I'd never met any of these people before, and now we're having conversations about technology training and access for veterans. So that was pretty special.
I like that, Brag and Borrow.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all taking ideas from others.
Of course.
Why not?
Nothing's
why
new.
Not formalize it?
And steal
let's get,
it.
Let's get together every 30 days or every 60 days or something. Okay.
The one thing I want to add, if we have time, is talking about evaluation and reporting on your impact is the hardest part of all of this, that at least for us, is how do we show the impact beyond the number of people who attended a computer class or the number of hours of training that were provided?
Yeah, we just have a couple of minutes left. Can we get to some ideas of how to do it?
Yeah, for sure. So I would say for us, it's knowing what the goal is of the individual or the group. And we're not doing it as well as I'd like to because we don't even have a data collection platform. We're working on Salesforce right now. So we're hoping by the summer we'll have that all built out. But what is the goal of the learner and how do we show that they've reached that goal? If it's ending isolation, so what are the things you need to do technology-wise to help them get connected so they're not feeling isolated? Or for job seekers, that's a little bit more clear-cut. Did they get a job, or do they feel like they're getting more hits on their resume? So it's really figuring out what are you hoping to accomplish, and then how do you build in the metrics to track that goal? And it's for small nonprofits, it's really difficult to do that well because you just don't have the staff to ask the right questions, collect the data in the right way to then be able to run reports at the end to show that there was impact there.
So what's the small organization to do? How can they just get as close as they can to reporting impact?
Well, you just start talking about it first, and, you know, don't beat yourself up if you can't do it, but at least try and find out from the individual learners, are you more comfortable, you know, whatever the goal of it. So if they want to get on social media, did they get, you know, after 6 months, were they able to do Facebook? Because to do Facebook, you need an email. And then to do email, you need to know how to open up a browser. So there's all these things that you need to layer on top. So that would be one thing is like, are you doing this now, whereas before you couldn't? You could say percentage-wise, that's an easy one to say, like 50% of our learners are now able to do this thing or 100%. So that would be an easy thing, but you do have to track it regularly and have it in a database. So I would say don't overwhelm yourself with things to collect. Just keep it simple and start small.
I do think it's important also, in addition to seeing if they know how often they're doing it, I mean, know how to do it, how often they're doing it.
That's right.
Because if you're really integrating that technology, yeah, it's not just the knowledge, it's if you're actually using it in a consistent manner.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely, okay. I agree.
All right. Ladies, we're going to leave it there.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, Cammie Griffiths, Executive Director of CTN, Community Technology Network. Karen Lincoln, Director of Business and Operations at the Stride Center, and Alicia Orozco, Manager of Administration and Special Projects for the Chicana Latina Foundation. Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio coverage of 16NTC, the Nonprofit Technology Conference. Thank you for being with us.
Your annual grants plan is coming up. First, Pursuant. They have more free research for you. Overcoming the Major Donor Dilemma is the most recent. This paper will help you with the identification, engagement, and cultivation of new major donors. Overcoming the Major Donor Dilemma. You'll find it at Pursuant.com. Click on Resources and then Content Papers. Check that out. We Be Spelling, Spelling Bees for Fundraising. They've got a new video up. It's from a night that raised money for HFC, which is Help for Children. The organization needed help for its programs, and it turned to We Be Spelling. They raised $110,000 that night. You'll see it all in the video at WeBeeSpelling.com. Now, Tony's Take Two. I've got new videos from last year's Nonprofit Technology Conference. I'm capturing these under the rubric Virtual Organizations and Volunteers, VOV, VOV, VOV. I have one on how to manage remote employees. Another is managing remote volunteers, where to find volunteers. And the fourth one is leveraging your expert or tech volunteers. My video that introduces these four with the links, you'll find it, you know where. Do I need to say it? Do I need to say it? TonyMartinetti.com. And by the way, are you going to this year's NTC? You'll find the info at n10.org. You know that's an excellent conference, the Nonprofit Technology Conference. That is Tony's Take Two. My pleasure to welcome Diane Leonard. She has been a grant professional for over a decade and is president and owner of D.H. Leonard Consulting and Grant Writing Services. She has secured over $34 million in competitive grants for clients from all three levels of government and private foundations. She's the co-host of Hashtag Grant Chat, a weekly Twitter chat for grant professionals. She's at Diane H. Leonard, and there's an E at the end of Diane, and only one N, make that very clear. And her company is at dhleonardconsulting.com. Diane Leonard, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be with you.
My pleasure. You have a credential GPC after your name. What is that?
Yes, so that stands for Grant Professional Certified. That's through the Grant Professional Certification Institute, a sister organization to the Grant Professionals Association. So very proud to have been in the field long enough to be able to test for that credential.
Okay, Grant Professional. Why don't they just make it Certified Grant Professional, CGP?
Could be that too. I don't know, but happy to have those initials and to be able to stand for our field that way.
Yeah, you might look into that. So just switch it. Just have them call it CGP, Certified Grant. Otherwise, it sounds Grant Professional Certified. It sounds like you should have a comma after professional, like rifle, comma M17, or something like that. Or I don't know. I would look into that. See if they'd switch that around. You don't think?
Absolutely.
Certified Grant Professional. I mean, doesn't that roll off a little easier? I don't know. No?
Well, like I said, I'm just happy to be able to be a part of the GPC community, and so I haven't thought to ask them that question.
Okay. You don't want to speak out against your professional association. That would cause trouble. I will never have the GPC. I'd be a GPU. I got Grant Professional Uncertified, but I'm not even a Grant Professional, so I'd be just a U, uncertified. I'd just have the letter U. Tony Martinetti, U, uncertified. Okay. Let's get into our grant plan for the year. I'd like to start with some basics. We should have a calendar, right? Looking forward for the year?
Yeah, absolutely. You should have a grant calendar that lets you, as the person writing the grants, and the rest of your team know what is coming. What do we have for deadlines? Where do we need to plan to be able to be a part of the grant process? Keep the stress level down.
Okay. And we're going to talk about other people who are part of this that may not typically be thought of, but we're trying to break down these misconceptions about who's part of the grants team. It's more than the grant writers. We're going to get to that.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. Oh, I also noticed you say that you like to say grant professional, but I usually see grants professional. Is there a split in the profession among whether you're singular or plural?
Oh, I think more than anything, there's a distinction. Some folks will call themselves a grant writer versus a grant professional. That's usually the question we get, versus a grant writer, grants writer, or a grants professional, grant professional.
Yeah. I'm asking the plural singular plural singular question.
Yeah, and usually we use singular, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I don't know.
Personal preference there, I think.
No, okay. The industry has not standardized itself.
there's some room for standardization still in the industry, for
okay.
sure.
Well, singular versus plural. I mean, I think these things are important. Scrutinize these things. Like CBG or ZGP. Okay. And so what should be a part of our grant calendar? What belongs in there?
Yeah, there's a fair amount that belongs in there.
Okay.
So upcoming deadlines for existing funders that an organization already has relationships with, those take priority. So what will be the deadlines related to their reports, to their relationship maintenance with those existing funders, and then renewal applications. Also on there should be any known deadlines for potential new funders, a corporate foundation, a family foundation, as well as the outreach that you might make to those foundations before you choose to apply. So whether you're going to a funder forum or participating in a webinar, a technical assistance session, those should be on there too. And then if you're looking at government funding, we're usually forecasting. We're not exactly sure when things will be out. So those best guesses, those forecasts for when you expect to see opportunities come out through the different either federal or state systems should be on the calendar as well as a trigger point so that you're watching for those opportunities to open and reminding yourself to pre-plan for them.
Okay. The outreach part of being a grant professional, correct me if I'm wrong in this statement, please, and I really do mean, you know, challenge me if I'm wrong, that the relationship part of grantsmanship or grant writing is underappreciated.
Often it is, and it's actually one of my dear friends and colleagues, Heather Stombach of Just Right Solutions, loves to say that people give to people, right? And that's not usually debated in the fundraising community or
yeah.
in nonprofits.
Yeah.
But the reality is, and this is where Heather takes it a step further, is that people, the foundations, are granting to people at the nonprofit. So it might not feel the same as a major donor interaction or an individual donor, but ultimately people are making those decisions, and so there is that opportunity for some dialogue, to ask questions, to have some interaction. Not with all grant makers, but it's an important factor that a lot of folks do skip over under the stress of a deadline, and ultimately in the long run are probably hurting their success ratio as a result.
Is it worth talking to the grant maker while you're in process, you're preparing your application?
Oh, 100%. So I started as a grant maker, and while talking to a program officer isn't ever a guarantee of anything, when you find a grant maker that has the preference and the capacity, we should maybe say it the other order, capacity and preference for some pre-award communication, it's going to help you as the applicant to write a more competitive proposal or potentially to realize, actually, maybe we're not a good fit, so save yourself the time.
Hmm.
And it helps the funder as well in the long run, again, if they have the capacity and the preference for that communication, because they're receiving stronger awards as a result of that dialogue.
Now, how do we assess whether they have capacity and preference? Can we just call and say, I don't have any specific question about the application? I mean, I understand it completely, but how do you open that conversation if you don't have specific questions about their process?
Right. So the way that we handle it and recommend that our clients do that outreach is through their research when they're looking at an opportunity, but they're looking at the website and they're seeing, what does the funder actually say? Right? Community Foundation for Southeast Michigan says right on there, please call us before you apply. They're crystal clear in their materials. They want to talk to you. Others will say, please email us, or please call the program officer, please call the program director, please email us. On the flip side, there will be those that in their materials will say, no inquiries accepted.
Mm, okay.
Right? So a lot of them are being pretty clear if they have a printed website or if they have an annual report. They're putting out information to try and make it easier for folks to understand what it is that they want or could allow to happen for communication. But I think really what's important is that you consistently develop talking points if you find a funder that you're going to have the opportunity to email with or call, maybe even meet in person.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we develop the talking points, they work just as well in person as they do on the phone, or they turn into a great email. So the first thing is to do a quick introduction. Who are you and who are you with? not the whole history of the organization, but just quick.
Okay.
Who I am, this is who I'm with.
Mm-hmm.
Calling because based on my research about your foundation, about your granting organization, I think that our organization is a really strong potential grant funding partner with you because. Give them a 30-second elevator speech. Why do you think that your work is well-aligned with theirs? Why should they want to talk to you?
Okay.
So elevator speech, or you're at a cocktail party. Yeah. You've got a quick 30 seconds with somebody before they run away.
So you're establishing up front that you've done research and you've thought this through.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. All right, here's why we're a match. What else?
And then the last part is that you're going to ask, may I ask you, I've got a few questions that will help me understand if we're going to be competitive in your process and make our application the best possible for you. If you've got the phone call going, they're likely going to say yes, or in person they're going to say yes. In email, you just dive into it. You're going to ask them 2 to 3 thoughtful questions. Thoughtful questions are things that are not in a funder's frequently asked question document. They are not things that are clearly outlined on their website.
Yes, yes.
Right? A thoughtful question is if you've read all their materials and you have a question. Geez, do you prefer to do a matching grant versus a 1-year straight project grant? Gee, are you willing to fund salaries? Is that an eligible expense? Those are legitimate, thoughtful questions.
Mm-hmm.
Could be that the way that they've described how they support education, you're wondering if indeed they'll actually support after-school activities versus only in-school tutoring programs, or whatever the case might be.
Yeah.
Something that's a little more programmatic. And you might say, well, their materials are really clear. I don't know. I'm not sure I have a thoughtful question. Just like anything else with people, people love to talk about themselves. So a thoughtful question to a funder, all that you might want to ask is, could you tell me about a recent grant that did a great job of sharing their outcomes with you, or that did a great job of publicizing the funded work? Get them to talk about something that they funded that went well, because that's going to give you a good example, something to think about for what did they like? How the work that you do, how could you talk about it to them in a similar way in the application?
I love it. Now, if you do this, if you open the door this way and have this thoughtful conversation, what percentile of grant applicants would you say you're putting yourself in?
You're putting yourself in the top tier for sure.
Yeah. It's just not it just doesn't happen. People don't think of the relationship part of grant work. All right. That was an excellent. Thank you for that digression. I took us there, but it's outside our plan.
It's important part. We call it the 3 R's. So first you research, then you do relationships. And lastly, you get to do your 3rd R of writing. Of course, doesn't start with an R, but we capitalize.
All right. That's right. Everybody.
But it's a quick thing. People skip the 2nd R. That's what we say all the time.
Yeah.
They do research and they do writing.
Yeah.
Skip everything in between.
Okay. We know that you know how to spell the word writing. So, you know,
well, I just wanted to clarify.
You're going for the alliteration, I understand, which I love. Which I very much appreciate. So it's fine. We all know you can spell. All right. All right. That's cool. All right, I like that. Okay. So. In putting our back to our calendar, we're putting this calendar together. There's considerable time we have to spend looking into all these things about deadlines and not only applications but renewals, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of time up front goes into this.
It is, but it really ends up saving you significant time in the long run, and it's usually well paired that you're working on your grant calendar creation while you're working with your peers, your colleagues, and your leadership. For what does that grant revenue line item look like in the operating budget for the year ahead? So at the same time that your organization is pausing to do budgeting work, you should be creating your grant calendar so that they're in synergy.
Yes, and not only amount, but timing too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. It's excellent. Now, see, I've had guests on talking about this generally, but never heard that. You have to align the revenue with the budget. Okay.
Yeah, otherwise everybody's going to be disappointed if the grant budget revenue line item is off, right? You as the person who was doing the writing and those that are in leadership responsible for that budget ultimately.
Yeah, could be worse than mere disappointment.
For sure.
Okay, let's take our first break. When we come back, Diane and I will continue talking about your annual calendar, and we'll get a little more in-depth, a little more advanced. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's Got More. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag nonprofitradio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like nonprofit radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there, too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
Lively conversation, top trends, sound advice. That's Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio. I'm Melanie Schnall-Begun, Managing Director, Morgan Stanley Philanthropy Management.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. I got to send the live love, et cetera. It's got to go out. We're pre-recorded, so I can't name you by city and state, but if you are among our live listeners today, the love goes out to you. Thanks so much for being with us. Not only love, but thanks. Gratitude and love. Podcast pleasantries, over 12,000. I'm prepared to say it now. It's happened so often that it's over 12,000. That's all there is to it. It's over 12,000 podcast listeners. It's just that simple. We're beyond that 10,000 mark, 10,000 threshold. So, pleasantries to the vast majority of our audience, the podcast listeners. Whatever device, whatever time, whenever you squeeze us into your busy, hectic schedule, pleasantries to you, our podcast listeners. Thanks so much for being with us. And the affiliate affections to our AM and FM stations throughout the country. Affections to you. I'm glad that you're listening. Let your station know that you do listen so they get some feedback. That's always valuable. Affections to our AM and FM affiliate listeners. Okay, Diane Leonard. This process necessarily involves goal setting. Let's talk some about that.
Sure. Having goals is really important for yourself, and so that the organization is in well alignment with their grant-seeking strategy and really articulating and achieving your strategic plan.
Okay, so what are some of the goals? You have lots of good metrics here. I love these metrics that you list, award percentage and percentage funded versus asked. We're setting goals for all these things.
Ideally, yes. What we find is that some organizations are only using one or two metrics to measure their grant-seeking success, when really there is a pretty long list of different metrics that can be used, and if used together, actually present you with a fuller picture of the success and where you're seeing growth or potentially room for improvement in your grant-seeking, so that you can try and sharpen your skills, have better success percentages overall, have a stronger return on investment on each grant that you write.
As we're setting our goals, what do we benchmark against? Is that to be organizations like us? Are those numbers even available? Or to what degree does the previous year factor in, or the previous 3 years?
Yeah, great question. People tend to be pretty tight about sharing their different personal metrics, and so it really is about looking at your organization organization's past track record, looking at 1, 2, and sometimes 3 years back to see what those different either success percentage, percent of current funders that are renewing, percent of each year to see what dollar amount or what number of total grants came from new funders versus previously existing relationships. If you look at those numbers, that you've got a longer-term history, it can show you sometimes there's some blips, things that happen because of government funding in or out that are beyond your control that would impact your metrics. So that's why you want to look at more than just the past year. Establish a benchmark, where were you, and set some goals, some realistic goals for yourself for how could you improve your work and hopefully your grant revenue as you move forward.
Mm. So it would be off color of me to ask you what your percentage of awards is. Is that an inappropriate question?
Oh, not at all. Totally appropriate, especially if you're talking to a grant consultant. We're usually pretty public.
Oh, okay.
So okay. My success percentage has stayed over 65% for my 11 years in business.
Okay. Is that how does that rank? I don't know.
Two-thirds. We're pretty proud of that.
Okay.
So I will say that with pride.
All right. So two-thirds of the applications that you submit over the past 11 years have been awarded.
Yes.
Is that right? Did I state that right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Two-thirds. All right. Excellent. All right, so let's talk through some of these. Percentage funded versus asked. I guess that's pretty straightforward. Again, you know, it's. I think the toughest part of this is figuring out where you fit in. Like, what should we be looking for? 90% funded versus asked, or is 50% good? It's tough.
It's very tough, and especially depending on what type of work you're doing and what type of grant maker you're applying to, what would be a good standard will be different. So, for example, NIH, when they publish their funded percentages, I mean, they're so incredibly competitive. All grant makers are, but at NIH, I think the last published statistic that I saw was that 13% of submitted proposals funded. 13%. So if that's all the work you're doing, you're probably going to be happy with a different number than if you are solely working with family foundations, or corporate and family foundations.
Percent of funding renewed and increased. Can you say something about that?
Sure. So if you look back at the last year and you see which funders you received funding from, you'd be looking then to say, well, how many of those will I retain? What percentage will I receive another grant from in this upcoming year? And ideally, what percentage could I increase an award from? So instead of getting another $75,000 grant, gosh, it'd be great if I could increase and get an $80,000 grant.
80, that's modest. I was thinking from 75 to 100. Was I crazy?
Right?
I mean,
push for those six-digit figures.
But you're the pro. Is that unreasonable to go expect somebody, a funder, to go from 75 to 100?
It's so situational.
Okay.
You know, for some, having the increase of a few thousand is a big deal. For others, you're right. You can make a much bigger jump depending on what you're proposing.
I mean, if you did a great job last year or over the past 2 years with them, and you have a way of expanding the program, wouldn't that be a credible argument for giving a 30% increase?
It certainly could be. And I think, you know, this actually goes back to that relationship point. If you've done more than just implement your project, but rather you've thought about how you can enhance your relationship with your grant maker in addition to doing what you said you would, when you said you would, how you said you would in your application, things, you stand a much better chance in terms of increasing your award in the future year.
Yes. Well, one of your metrics is grant compliance. How do we measure that?
When you look at the different grants that are being implemented, for some, you know, if you're talking government grants, we've got very strict standards from the OMB office federally, but if we're looking at grant compliance, you could measure yourself on percent of reports turned in on time or early, percent of grant bills turned in on time or early. Even simple metrics like that go a long way, because as soon as you turn a report in late, you've hurt your trust and your relationship with a grant maker.
Yes, very much, and your credibility is diminished, yeah. Diane, we may have to have you back because we only have like 2 minutes left. But I want to get to the use of your colleagues and expanding the definition of who belongs on the grant team. Please, talk about that.
Sure. So when we say grant team, folks will say, I'm a grant team of one.
Yeah.
And what we really mean, when I talk about grant team, when those that I work with, when we talk about grant team, what we mean are those organizations that play a key role in giving you, helping you give it to put together competitive applications. So it's leadership for saying, yes, this is a good idea. It's in alignment with our strategic plan. It's somebody from finance helping giving you the budget numbers. It's a vice president of programs or a program director that's telling you, here's what goes in that logic model form. Here's what goes in your work plan form. They might not call themselves formally ever a grant team, but they are your pre-award grant team. Then you have a post-award grant team, might be slightly different players, that are helping to make sure a grant is implemented the way that it was proposed, that funder information is being shared back via reports. If there's a need for financial billing or need to do a revision to a budget, they're helping and working with you or your grant manager if your organization has one. They're working together for that. So, again, might not ever call themselves a grant team formally. You might not ever see it on the org chart, but they exist. It's not truly a solo role to be in grants.
We have to leave it there. I hope you'll come back again because
there's
a lot more to discuss in some of these topics. And I got to leave it there. Thank you so much. You will find Diane's company at dhleonardconsulting.com, and she is at Diane H. Leonard. Again, Diane, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tony.
My pleasure. Next week, a very special show. Atlas of Giving CEO Rob Mitchell announces the fundraising results of 2016 and the forecast for 2017. With us will be Paul Shervish, emeritus professor at Boston College, and Professor Doug White from Columbia, commenting on the review and the forecast. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled. And by Weebee Spelling, super cool spelling bee fundraisers. WeebeeSpelling.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. Gavin Dahl is our AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. And this music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yeah, it was like, yes. It was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.